Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Molly Malakar, the director of Bat Shalom, or Daughters for Peace, an Israeli feminist group who discusses the escalating violence between Israel, Lebanon, and the Palestinians, and her group's search for a just solution to the decades-long conflict. Wells Dixon, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who assesses the congressional debate over how detainees held at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, will be tried. And activist Diane Wilson, who explains why she and thousands of others across the world are conducting a hunger strike to demand that U.S. troops be withdrawn from Iraq. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the aftermath of North Korea's provocative July 4th missile tests, South Korea, which has friendly relations with its northern communist neighbor, has suspended all shipments of humanitarian aid. According to the Washington Post, a North Korean delegation was visiting South Korea at the time of the declaration and responded by breaking off all talks with South Korea. Over the last decade, South Korea has followed a sunshine policy of engagement with North Korea. However, in mid-July, South Korea rejected any discussion regarding a 500,000-ton shipment of rice until North Korea returned to the six-party nuclear talks, which include China, Russia, South Korea, Japan, and the United States. Before the aid cutoff, South Korea provided the second highest level of economic aid to North Korea, only behind China. The United Nations Security Council recently passed a resolution condemning North Korea's missile tests. The resolution, backed by China and Russia, included no reference to North Korea being a threat to international peace and security or the possibility of military action. The six-party nuclear talks with North Korea broke down in September 2005 after the Bush administration imposed new economic sanctions against North Korea for currency counterfeiting. Hardliners in the administration also squashed a proposed meeting between Assistant Secretary of State Chris Hill and North Korean Vice Foreign Minister Kim Gai-gwan in April, designed to get the six-party talks back on track. The London-based Guardian newspaper reports a Rome court is hearing the case of human rights abuses by five Argentine military officers for killing Italian citizens during the 1970s Dirty War. The five ex-Navy officers who were not present for the trial are charged with kidnapping, torture, and murder. Prosecutors say the soldiers were part of a unit that rounded up suspected leftists and then took them to the torture center known as the Navy School of Mechanics. Three of the victims had a dual Italian-Argentine citizenship. One of the victims, Susana Pegoraro, was pregnant at the time of her abduction and gave birth to a girl before she was murdered. Like hundreds of other children born to political prisoners during the Dirty War, the girl was given to a childless military family. Human rights groups in Italy say there were hundreds of political prisoners in Argentina of Italian descent, among the 30,000 civilians killed during the military dictatorship. Massimo Carlotta, author of a book on Argentina's disappeared, has campaigned hard for the Rome trial. As Carlotta told The Guardian, the trial is about making sure that these crimes are not forgotten. The accused will never again be able to set foot outside Argentina, because they would face international justice. In the last two presidential elections, two Republican secretaries of state, Katherine Harris in 2000 and Kenneth Blackwell in 2004, played a key role in deciding the outcome. Harris and Blackwell were heavily criticized for politicizing the voting process, which is overseen by the Secretary of State's office. Allegations of malfeasance include unequal distribution of voting machines, intimidation of potential voters, and tweaking the recount process to aid the campaign of George W. Bush. According to The Nation magazine, a new crop of progressives is running for Secretary of State this fall, usually an obscure state-level office. Mark Ritchie, who ran the 2004 National Voice voter registration campaign that signed up 5 million new voters, is challenging Minnesota's Republican Secretary of State, Mary Kiffmeyer. In California, State Senator Deborah Bowen has blasted companies like Diebold for lax standards. She won the nomination for Secretary of State and the backing of progressives for recognizing that there is a risk of fraud with new computerized voting machines. In Massachusetts, John Bonifaz, founder of the National Voting Rights Institute, who led the fight for a recount in Ohio after the 2004 election, is mounting a primary challenge against incumbent Secretary of State Bill Galvin, a moderate Democrat. Bonifaz has criticized Galvin for opposing same-day voter registration and seeks to boost registration among non-English-speaking residents. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
When the radical Shiite Muslim group Hezbollah attacked Israel from inside Lebanon, killing 8 Israelis and taking 2 soldiers hostage, Israel retaliated with a full-scale attack on Lebanon. Scores of civilians have been killed, and Israel has imposed a sea, land, and air blockade, which it insists it won't lift until its captured soldiers are returned. This all follows attacks by Israel against Palestinians in Gaza after Palestinian militants there raided a military post in Israel, killing 2 soldiers and taking 1 prisoner. The Palestinians said their action was in response to the economic strangulation of the Palestinian Authority since Hamas came to power in March and the increasing number of civilians killed by Israeli military actions. In the face of rising violence, there are still groups in both Israel and Palestine working for peace. One such organization is the Jerusalem Link, established in 1993 by Israeli Jewish women and Palestinian Arab women to promote political dialogue. In 2004, the groups formed the International Women's Commission, a coalition of 60 female activists and government officials, 2/3 of whom are Israelis and Palestinians. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Molly Malikar, an Israeli who is the director of Bat Shalom, or Daughters for Peace, a feminist group which participates in the Jerusalem Link and the International Women's Commission. Malikar says what brings women of diverse backgrounds together is the need to introduce gender and civil perspectives to the struggle for a just solution to the conflict, which they define as a two-state solution. She says Israel has a right to defend itself from attacks within its pre-1967 borders, but she explains that the current escalation of the conflict lies in political and military decisions that Israel made over the past year.
For a long time, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is the core conflict, is not approaching any sustainable arrangement which will satisfy both sides. And I want to emphasize both sides. In the past year, there were several actions made by the Israeli government, mainly this unilateral disengagement from Gaza. And this whole concept of unilateralism, saying that Israel will decide by its own what will be the terms of any political arrangement, what will be the borders, how the Palestinian people will deal with their own life without negotiating with them. So this mentality, which the current government hoped to continue with this conversion plan within the West Bank, expanding the Israeli settlements, doing all kind of provocations such as targeted assassinations, etc., was breeding this content. And it was very clear, and you read the civil society groups working on the ground and having constant contact with our Palestinian colleagues, know it for a while, and we have been alarming the international community to take responsibility and saying that this will end with another violent phase.
And it certainly has ended with another violent phase. So, Molly Malikar, how did the Israeli peace movement relate to Israel's unilateral actions?
One of the crises that the Israeli peace camp faced last year was how to approach this unilateral disengagement from Gaza that Sharon's government committed. Because on one hand, it was a great temptation to believe that at least settlements are being dismantled, the Israeli army is getting out of the Gaza Strip, and this is, you know, one of the things that we have been fighting for decades now. But on the other hand, and the criticism was heard last year, I admit, not by the mainstream of the peace movement, but the more, let's say, progressive, and if you want to call it the more radical groups within the peace camp, saying that it is dangerous because once it is done on unilateral basis, once the Gaza Strip is handed to nobody, in a way. I mean, when you have negotiations, you have a partner on which you put responsibility when you get out of the territory. And beside that, this unilateralism was packaged so well by the Israeli government to the world, saying that this is some sort of peace action. Well, we know that from outside, the Israeli army continued to control the entire Gaza Strip. So the occupation, if you want to call it, or the oppression or the control over Gaza was not stopped ever. It was just dealt by other means from outside. And, of course, it created a huge pressure within the Gaza Strip. And then there was, of course, the rise of the Hamas government, which was another excuse for the Israeli government saying there is no partner. And this delegitimation of the democratically elected authority was another kind of pillar to this escalation.
What's your best hope for stopping the violence and getting people back to the bargaining table?
An honest broker is definitely needed. More strong voices of the more progressive international community, ceasefire, exchange of prisoners. These are the immediate ends that should be met very immediately. But soon after that, we have to make sure that the international community does not go back and leave another vacuum. We have to make sure that the international community accompanies further political negotiations and ending the core, you know, the core reason of this conflict, which is the Israeli occupation. As an Israeli citizen, a mother to a child, raising a daughter here within Jerusalem, there's something I must add. Israel needs security. It is, you know, my right for security, but I know that my security will never be fulfilled or never be safe if the neighbor is insecure.
That was Molly Malakar of the Israeli feminist peace group Bat Shalom. For more information, visit the group's website at www.batshalom.org. The June 29th Supreme Court decision, which found that President George Bush's plan to try detainees held at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, by military commissions, violated both the U.S. Uniform Code of Military Justice and the Geneva Conventions, has sparked congressional debate on the legal rights these terrorist suspects should be accorded. President Bush had initially wanted to subject hundreds of detainees held at Guantanamo to proceedings that would allow the use of evidence obtained from coercive interrogation, a euphemism for torture, and limit a detainee's right to hear evidence introduced against them. White House lawyers and some Republicans in Congress are advocating that legislation should be passed to legalize the military commissions struck down by the Supreme Court. But a bipartisan group of legislators and military lawyers advocate trials for the detainees based on the Uniform Code of Military Justice that guides court-martials of U.S. soldiers. In testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing July 13th, top lawyers from the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines expressed public disagreement with the Bush administration on how terrorist suspects held at Guantanamo and elsewhere should be treated. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Wells Dixon, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights that represents Guantanamo Bay detainees. He assesses the congressional debate over how detainees held at Guantanamo will be tried.
The Supreme Court decided in the recent Hamdan decision by a 5-3 vote that the military commissions that President Bush had established to try Guantanamo Bay detainees who were accused of war-related crimes was unlawful And the court did so in two respects. First, the court held that the commissions violated the Uniform Code of Military Justice because the commissions, as created by President Bush, did a couple of things, such as exclude detainees from portions of their trial. It allowed them to be convicted based on evidence that the detainee was not allowed to see or hear. And the second thing that the court did was that it held that the commissions violated Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. These are the provisions in the Geneva Conventions that apply to all combatants, regardless of whether they're prisoners of war or not. And what these common provisions do is essentially establish a baseline, that is, an international minimum of standard of care, if you will, for decency, morality, and ethics for those who are captured during times of war.
What is the next step here? It seems that the Republican majority in Congress is looking to do a quick fix here to satisfy the U.S. Supreme Court in that the court stated, I believe, that the Bush administration's method of trial for these detainees was not approved by Congress. So it seems they're just trying to dot the I's and cross the T's here without any substantial change in the White House method.
Right. Well, the process would be much, much more complicated than that, I can assure you. And in fact, legislation really is not necessary in the wake of the Hamdan decision. We have in the United States already an established system that's capable of handling these commissions for detainees, and that's the court-martial system under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It's fully capable of handling these sorts of trials. I'd point out, though, that even under the old system, that is the military commissions that were struck down by the Supreme Court, the Bush administration had only charged approximately 10 people out of more than 700 that have passed through Guantanamo Bay. So I don't think that additional legislation and additional litigation over this legislation would really accomplish anything in terms of Guantanamo Bay and solving the problems that we have here. It's not really clear what Congress is trying to do. It seems to me that they're having a lot of debates, not only between the Republican majority and the Democratic minority, but also within the parties about what, if anything, to do in the wake of Hamdan. You may recall that just prior to the Hamdan decision coming down, President Bush stated publicly that he was waiting for the Supreme Court to decide this case, and that once the case was decided, he wanted to close Guantanamo Bay. Well, the Supreme Court's now spoken, and President Bush certainly has the power to close the base. That seems to me to be the solution here, not additional legislation and additional litigation.
There were some hearings on Capitol Hill last week where some active duty and retired military judges and attorneys came before the committee there and told Congress that they approved of what the Supreme Court was trying to accomplish in terms of respecting the Geneva Conventions when it comes to how to judicially treat these detainees held at Guantanamo. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would.
Right. Well, the United States has, since the 1950s, followed the Geneva Conventions in all respects. It wasn't until this latest conflict that any American president had determined that the Geneva Conventions did not apply to our enemies in wartime. That, I think, is particularly troubling for members of the armed forces because it establishes a precedent abroad that says essentially that if the United States is not required to comply with the Geneva Conventions, neither are we, and that obviously puts American service personnel at risk themselves.
The Bush administration seems to be appealing to many people's basic instincts to say we were attacked on 9/11 and we have to use any and every means necessary to protect this country up into including violating international law. Politically speaking, I think they're trying to bank on people's blind faith that the Bush administration methods will somehow protect the United States better than adhering to international law. What's your reaction?
My reaction is the same reaction that others have had lately, which is to say that what the Bush administration is doing here really has more to do with the expansion of presidential power than it does with trying detainees. The Supreme Court held in Hamdan, though, that the president cannot establish military commissions and act beyond what Congress has authorized him to do in these cases. So there are limitations clearly on presidential power.
That was Wells Dixon, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights that represents detainees held at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Contact the center by calling area code 212-614-6464 or visit their website at www.ccr-ny.org. On July 4th, Code Pink Women for Peace and Gold Star Families launched a hunger strike dubbed Troops Home Fast. Organizers of the fast are demanding that all U.S. troops be withdrawn from Iraq, no permanent bases be established there, and a commitment from the U.S. to fund the reconstruction of Iraq using Iraqi workers. A group of long-term fasters, including anti-war activists Cindy Sheehan, Dick Gregory, and Daniel Ellsberg, are conducting their fast in front of the White House in the nation's capital. Organizers of the fast say that the hunger strike will continue through September 21st, International Peace Day, when activists will engage in a week of nonviolent civil disobedience against the war. Members of Congress, including Representatives Barbara Lee, Maxine Waters, Dennis Kucinich, Lynn Woolsey, and Cynthia McKinney, have expressed support for the hunger strike. In mid-July, more than 4,000 people had signed on to conduct their own solidarity fasts in the U.S. and in 22 other nations. Among the fasters at the White House is Diane Wilson, a fourth-generation Texas Gulf Coast shrimper, mother of five, and since 1989, one of the nation's most effective grassroots environmental activists. Wilson, a co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace and author, has conducted seven previous hunger strikes and visited Iraq before the war. Between the Lines Scott Harris spoke with Diane Wilson, who was in the 15th day of a water-only fast, about the power of a hunger strike and the overall objectives of the Troops Home Fast.
Well, what we're trying to do is we're going to stay on this hunger strike until there is a solid, serious plan that will start bringing the troops home. And we're looking for immediate withdrawal, and we're looking for a timetable, and I know probably some people out there think it's naive, and I know a lot of people think because I've said it's open-ended and I intend to stay there until it happens is that I'm a suicidal nut. I've been told that a few times. But, you know, the thing of it is I have seen the power of a hunger strike because it comes from a different place than your typical protest or your demonstration or your petition writing. It has a spiritual element to it, and it's very powerful, and Gandhi called it a soul power. And, you know, I've used it for 15 years. I've did it seven times, and it just seems that it puts this vortex of energy out there, and it almost, like, creates action, and you could never have ever planned that it would happen like it did, but it just happens, and I believe it creates action, and I have not the slightest doubt that it won't happen. I have no doubt.
Diane Wilson, why are you putting your life on the line to demand very dramatically with your fast withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq? What does this mean to you personally?
Well, I tell you what, I guess the best thing I ever read, it was a comment by Daniel Berrigan, who was very, very famous for his struggle during the Vietnam War and starting it and stopping it, and also, you know, how he's fought against these nuclear weapons. And he said, there's no peace because there's no peacemakers. And he said, to be a peacemaker, you have to be willing to go to that same place that people who are making these wars, you have to be willing to disrupt your life. You might have to be facing jail, and you might have to be facing death. And the thing of it is these war makers, they will certainly commit our children. They will certainly put our children's life on the line, and they will certainly put those Iraqi people's lives on the line. And if we can't be as serious about peace as they are about war, I think we have to go to that place. I really do. You know, I was raised Pentecostal and all my life, and I guess some of the strongest thing I remembered, and I think I remember it when I was very, very young, and it made a real strong impression on me, is that the greater love is laying down your life for your friend. And I believe we are all brothers and sisters. I absolutely believe that, you know, and even the Constitution talks about equal rights, and it's like, is it equal rights for us, and it's not equal rights for them? You know, to me, it was saying the same thing. It's not, you know, you and your brother are the same, and I just believe you have to live it. There is so much we say, and it's just talk. I mean, it's like talk, and I get so tired of the talk, and then we go out there, and all this destruction and war, and so, you know, I think you have to walk the walk, and if you believe in what you say you believe in, then you have to walk that real tough line there.
Diane, why do you oppose the Iraq War? And I would say this in the context of there are many people who say, well, the Iraq War was certainly initiated on false pretenses. There were no weapons of mass destruction. However, now that we're there, we have to complete the mission, as President Bush and his allies like to say. Why do you think we should withdraw right now when there's so much ethnic violence there on the ground, and a lot of people say, hey,
well,
there's going to be a bloodbath if the U.S. troops pick up and leave?
Well, I think the latest thing they say we went over there for is democracy, and 87% of the people of Iraq wants us out. All of their officials want us out. So it's like, They want us out, and all of the people, you know, the majority of the people in the United States want us out. And it's like Bush needs to listen to the American people and listen to what the Iraqi, their own government is saying, what the people are saying. They are saying, get out. And I think it's time for us to get out. To me, this is a very immoral and unjust war, you know. I think it's time, it's very much time to get out and let those people settle it themselves. And I think we've helped create the Civil War, quite frankly. I really do.
That was hunger striker Diane Wilson, author of the book An Unreasonable Woman, a true story of shrimpers, politicos, polluters, and the fight for Seadrift, Texas. Get more information on the hunger strike by visiting the group's website at www.troopshomefast.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Tok. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Vanzari.